We're now going to proceed to talk our way through a series of rules. These are rules, just like what we have for physician-patient relationship, that tell you what the right answer is on your USMLE Step 1 exam. Let's pause for a moment. I'm about to give you some advice which I am consciously aware will contradict directly some of the things you were told about practicing medicine in medical school, and I'm comfortable with that because my job here is not to prepare you for medical practice, it's to tell you how to get the questions right on the exam. If you want legal advice on medical practice, my suggestion, go hire an attorney. If you want to know how to get the questions right on the exam, listen up. Here are the rules. Rule number one, a competent patient has the right to refuse medical treatment. If the patient says no, it's no. They have the right to say no. It's not your decision, it's the patient's decision. This is critical. Now, people go to court all the time arguing that this right to refuse treatment ought to have some limitations. They go to court arguing that, well, I know the patient said no, but I need to intervene in order to preserve life because, of course, preserving life is the highest good. They go to court all the time arguing, I must intervene because to not intervene is like, it's the moral equivalent of helping the patient commit suicide, which, of course, I will not do. Third, they go to court all the time arguing that I must intervene, if not for this patient's sake, then for the sake of third parties. If not for this man's sake, then for the sake of his six children, I must intervene for their greater good. Or for the ethical standard of my profession. I took an oath, and because of that oath, I must intervene. My own professional ethics requires it. I lay out these four reasons so I can now say this sentence to you. On the exam, and indeed in real life, none of these work. They're all wrong answers. None of these are reasons to not listen to the decision of the competent patient, period. A competent patient has the right to refuse medical treatment. You like that one? You'll love this one. Assume competence. Assume the patient is competent. If you're not clear whether they're competent or not, they are. I just took away the middle ground. There is no uncertainty here. You either have a court designation of incompetence, because competence is a legal issue, or you have clear behavioral evidence of incompetence. Otherwise, they're competent. Listen to what they say. Diagnosis by itself tells you nothing about a patient's competence. Here's a man, I know it doesn't look like it, but he's been schizophrenic for the last 20 years. Competent? Of course, all I told you is he was schizophrenic. Here's a woman with Alzheimer's dementia. She's had that for the last 10 years. Is she competent? Yes. All I told you was a diagnosis. Diagnosis doesn't tell you competence. All diagnosis tells you is medical label. What blood alcohol level renders somebody incompetent? No. Competency is not a blood test. Competency is a legal decision. There is no blood alcohol level to determine competence. How do you know whether a patient is competent or not? Assume that they are, unless you have clear evidence that they're not. Here's clear evidence that they're not. Patient comes in the emergency department, their arm is a mess of blood and veins, skin flayed. You're trying to stop the bleeding. The patient comes to consciousness and says, no, I was trying to kill myself. Please just let me die. Do we just let them die? No, because trying to kill yourself is clear behavioral evidence of incompetence. Two, I'm interviewing this patient here who I know has a diagnosis of schizophrenia. As I'm talking to this patient, his eyes begin to roll back into his head. He starts to drool out of the side of his mouth. He giggles uncontrollably, falls to the ground, and starts beating his head rhythmically on the linoleum floor. What do you think? Competent? No, of course not. By clear common sense definition, this is not competence, and you would therefore act accordingly. But notice what I've done for you. If you're sitting on the fence, if you're on the borderline, if you are not sure, they're competent. There's no middle ground here. Number three, as much as possible, decision-making should occur within the medical setting. That means, concretely, the decision that says go to court is probably wrong. You make the judgment. In real life, the courts say, hey, we're really busy. We don't have time to adjudicate every little thing. You pass your licensing exams. You're supposed to know the law. You make the call. Now, in real life, we do go to court. We go to court if there's questions about the patient's competence, questions about who the surrogate should be, questions about decisions on life support. But on the exam, you're not going to get those because they want to see what you can decide. You make the call. There's only one time on the exam when we want you to go to court. That's when you believe the surrogate, the guardian, is making decisions that are not in the interest of the patient. In this instance, it is obviously your role to be a patient advocate, to step in and do what you perceive is, or at least argue for what you perceive, is the best interest of the patient. A child is diagnosed with juvenile onset diabetes. The child, age 9, requires treatment or will certainly be dead within the next 2 to 3 months. The parents, however, have strong religious convictions, and they wish to simply take the child home and pray for the child's well-being along with the circle of their religious community. What's the likely outcome of this case? Well, this will end up in court. Why? Well, the court will take over medical guardianship of the child, not because they disagree with the religion, that's irrelevant, but because they don't perceive the parents acting in the interest of the child as we consensually understand that. Notice, in this instance, it's not an emergency. And because it's not an emergency, you just can't intervene. You still need permission, in this case, from the court, not from the parents. That's really the only case we're going to court is going to be the issue. Number 4, when surrogates make decisions for patients, they have to make them using the following criteria and in this order. First, they have to use subjective standard. What historically did the patient say in the past? Second, if you don't have that, then you drop to substituted judgment. Remember Karen Ann Quinlan? Substituted judgment, the issue here is simply, well, you never said what you want, but I know you. I know the kind of person you are, and so I'll represent what you want. And finally, third, the best interest standard. If nobody knows you, nobody here knows anything about you. No one has a clear sense of what your wishes might be. Well, we're going to do for you what most people would want done, given the benefits and the burdens of the available courses of action. With these three rules in place, you're able to answer very complex, even very difficult questions because the questions are answerable by the rules. Try this simple question. It's been a busy night in the emergency department. The end of the shift, it always seems to be the end of the shift, an 87-year-old woman is brought in by her adult daughter who had been caring for her at her home. The 87-year-old woman is in a coma, is non-responsive, and is diagnosed as being in a persistent vegetative state from which she is unlikely to regain consciousness. She could probably be kept alive almost indefinitely on life support, but you're not sure how to proceed. You begin to have a conversation with her daughter about what you should do. Her daughter, upon hearing about his mother's prognosis, becomes very distraught and breaks out crying. You wait while she composes herself. And now you begin again to have the conversation on how you should proceed. The daughter says, I don't know, I'm not sure, I just don't know. And you prod her further. She says, look, doc, I really don't want to make this decision. If I had to, I'd say, well, I think she just went off life support terminated because she always said she hated to be a burden to people. But I'm not just that sure. As you're having this conversation, into the emergency department burst this 87-year-old woman's adult son. The son had been somewhat estranged from his mother, living out in the state of California, some 2,000 miles away, but raced to the hospital upon hearing about his mother's worsening medical condition. He was able to get there so quickly because he flew to a nearby airport in his private jet, helicoptered directly to the roof of the hospital. He's able to pay for the somewhat lavish lifestyle because he makes a very good living as a malpractice attorney, suing physicians for bad medical decisions. The son says, doctor, you haven't even tried anything yet. Before you even think about terminating life support, you must at least try the standard treatments and interventions. At this point, the question stops and says, what action should the physician take? Well, if you're following the rules, it should be obvious. We're going to listen to what the daughter says. Why? because the daughter there with the mother, non-estranged like the son is, has most likely to represent her wishes. She's the one with best substituted judgment. Notice we're not saying daughters are good and sons are bad. You can easily conceive of the same scenario being written with the son being the close one, the daughter being the estranged one. It's merely who is most likely to be your best window into the wishes of the patient. Rule number 5. If the patient is incompetent, the physician may rely on advance directive. Advance directive is a statement of the patient's wishes, an explicit statement. Here are the kickers for the exam. 1, advance directive can be oral. This doesn't have to be a written document. If the patient talks to you and tells you what they want, that's it. That's enough. Living will is what you'd like to have, however. Living will is a nice document, signed, sealed, witness, notarized, that says, should I become incapacitated, this is what I do and do not wish to have done to me. If you have a living will, follow it. It's clear, subjective standard, an expression of the patient's wishes. Health power of attorney. I want you to treat health power of attorney as a trump card. It beats everything that's on the table. When I say trump card, I mean if you have a conflict between the health power of attorney and a living will, go with the health power of attorney. See, the person with health power of attorney literally, quote, speaks with the patient's voice, unquote. It's the patient talking to you. Listen to what they say. If somebody has a living will, but they're conscious and they say, don't listen to my living will, you wouldn't listen to it, right? So follow the health power of attorney. It beats everything else. Don't fight this. If they give you a question with someone as health power of attorney, say thank you, God, and mark the answer. Your exam question just got easier. Number 6 reminds you that the feeding tube is a medical treatment and can be withdrawn at the patient's request. This is troublesome to some people, but the Cruzon case makes this clear. A competent patient has the right to refuse even life-saving hydration and nutrition. If the patient says no, it's no. Well, what about if the patient has anorexia nervosa? That's not actually as much of an issue as you might first think it is by the question. First of all, what's onset of anorexia nervosa? Well, it's usually in the teenage years, right? When, as we'll talk about in just a moment, the patient is a minor and therefore not legally competent, so their wishes are non-relevant. But let's suppose you do have an adult with anorexia nervosa. This one will easily be resolved in the courts. Every court in the country will recognize anorexia nervosa as a life-threatening condition and will take over medical guardianship of your patient. Wait, we talk about refusing food and water. Aren't we getting awfully close to assisted suicide, euthanasia? Sure we are, but here's the clear borderline between right and wrong on the exam. On the right side, passively not doing, not treating at the patient's request, even if it ends up in their death, yes, that's acceptable if that's their wish. On the other side, unacceptable, actively doing anything to speed up the time of death. No, you can't leave morphine vials on the table and go walking out of the room. Of course not. Wrong. Nor are you even supposed to be giving them medication for pain that goes over into the area of causing respiratory depression. Now, let's be clear. If your patient's in pain, we want you to relieve their pain. We want you to do everything you can to relieve their pain. The painkillers, do it in any way you can think of to provide them comfort. But we expect you to have the expertise to not end up killing your patient at the same time. Number 8. The physician has the job of deciding when the patient is dead, not other people. This goes right to the heart of something which is often referred to as futile treatment. I want you to understand there's two senses in which we mean this term, futile treatment. Let me put them side by side for you. On one hand, you have a patient that's been in a coma for a while. You've done everything you can to treat the patient. The patient seems shown no recovery. You don't really think there's much else that really legitimately could or should be done. There are a few other things you could try, some obscure things you read about, something a colleague once recommended, but really your clinical experience says this is pretty much hopeless. Yet, the family wants you to keep treating. What should you do? Well, then you should keep treating. Because in that sense of futile, you don't think it'll do any good. It's not your decision to make. The patient decides. If the patient can't, the patient's family, as the surrogate, makes that decision. That's the first sense of futile treatment. Here's the second. You've been treating this patient who's been in a persistent vegetative state for the last month, monitoring the patient closely, doing whatever you can think of to try to get a reaction or improvement. You notice that over the last 24-hour period, you have two flatline EEGs. In fact, further examination shows you've not been able to record any cortical activity on any EEG that's been taken. The family comes to see you, telling with great excitement that they've discovered a specialist out in California that they're flying in special to take a look at their loved one. What action should the physician take? Well, folks, the patient's dead. You got two flatline EEGs 24 hours apart, that's cortical death. Call the death and terminate life support. What about the specialist coming in? Tell him to stay home, the patient's dead. Who gets to declare death? You do. This is a different sense of futile treatment. The family still has hope, but folks, you don't treat corpses. Once you decide the patient's dead, you just let it go. It's sad, but true. Number 9. Never abandon a patient. This is so simple to say, but it happens so often in unexpected ways. Your patient runs out of insurance, lacks financial resources, doesn't seem to know what to do next, and you say, well, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Absolutely not. You're clear on the exam, you're never going to deny treatment to someone because they can't pay, right? You're clear to someone that you're always going to make sure they get the treatment, even if it means you get paid nothing for your effort, because your primary obligation is to get the patient the care they need. If you have an annoying patient, a difficult patient, a patient that you find just really objectionable, it's not acceptable to say, I can't be your doctor anymore. Now, if there's something serious that makes it so difficult you really can't objectively be the doctor, then that's a judgment call you can make. In that case, you can't simply say, I'm sorry, I won't be your doctor. You need to arrange that they have care and follow up to make sure that they're getting it. You're not even allowed to threaten a patient with abandonment. Some physicians, in the interest of trying to motivate their patients to be adherent with the prescribed treatment, say things like, look, unless you do what I'm telling you to do, I just can't continue to be your patient. No, that's oh so wrong. You're not allowed to even threaten abandonment. By one ethicist's view, abandonment is the worst ethical thing a physician can do. Once they're your patient, they're your patient. You are to dedicate yourself to making sure they get and continue to get the care they need. Let's talk about informed consent, number 10. When do you get informed consent? Always. Before you're allowed to do any intervention, any procedure, give any drug to a patient, you must have their informed consent. Now, informed consent means the patient has received and understood 5 key pieces of information. What are the 5? The nature of the procedure, the purpose or rationale, the benefits, the risk, and the one most often forgotten, the availability of alternatives. You have to tell them, if not this, these are the other options. Note what I just said. You have to lay out all the alternatives. If you're a surgeon, you must also lay out all the medical options. If you're an internist, you must also lay out all the surgical options. Failure to list even one vitiates informed consent. You know what gag clauses are? Y'all familiar with that concept of gag clauses? Well, gag clauses are parts of physicians' contracts with managed care organizations that used to say, you physician can only talk to patients about treatments that we certify as reasonable or effective treatments. Gag clauses have always been implicitly and now are explicitly illegal. Why were they clearly illegal? Because they violate informed consent. Anybody that suggests you should not tell a patient about an option, it's clearly wrong. Now, having told you the rule that you always get, you always have to give information and get informed consent, let's talk about the exceptions. There are four. When do you not deal with informed consent? One, emergency. Emergency changes everything. The patient comes into the ER, they're in a desperate medical state. You don't try to slap them awake and tell them what you're going to do. You go ahead and you treat now and tell them later. Second, waiver by the patient. A waiver is where the patient agrees not to get informed consent. This might happen commonly in a research situation. You know, I'd like to tell you all the benefits and the risks, but I don't know them yet. That's why we're doing the research. Is that okay? Okay, the patient says, that's a waiver. Or, I'm going in for surgery. I think it's your appendix, but if it's not, I'd like to take care of whatever else it is. Is that okay? Yes, that's okay. That's a waiver. Now, don't assume you have a waiver unless the question tells you explicitly you have it. Don't assume that anybody going in for surgery gave you blanket permission. In general, the rule is if you're going in for surgery to do one thing and you find out that's not the problem, instead it's something different, well, here's the issue. If it's life-threatening, then you're going to deal with it under the emergency clause. If it's non-life-threatening, then what you ought to do, close the patient up, wake them up. When they're alert, you want to talk to them and get full informed consent about what you want to do before proceeding to do that procedure. If you're in with surgery, you're able to deal with emergencies, but you're not to do something different that wasn't what you got permission to do. Third, you can't get informed consent from an incompetent patient. Only competent patients can give you consent. And the fourth exception is called therapeutic privilege. Courts decide competence. Doctors exercise therapeutic privilege. Therapeutic privilege is your right, no, your obligation to deprive the patient of their autonomy in the interest of their health, their safety, or the health and safety of other people. In most states, you're allowed to detain anybody who you think is a danger to themselves or others for 48 to 72 hours. Do it. You're supposed to prevent harm. What rule allows me to take that patient bouncing off the walls on PCP and slap them into restraints, even though the patient's screaming, no, no, let me out of here? It's called therapeutic privilege. Use it. You're going to hold the patient because they are indeed a danger to themselves and are indeed a danger to others. Prevent harm at all times. Informed consent can be oral. Understand, informed consent doesn't mean a signature on the bottom of a piece of paper. It means, I emphasize again, the patient has received and understood five pieces of information. If the patient simply takes the clipboard from you, signs the bottom, and hands it back without reading it, you have not gotten informed consent. Don't even pretend that you have. And written consent could be revoked orally at any time. If all the paperwork's in place, the patient's gotten all the information, and now as they're being wheeled into surgery, they say, no, wait, I changed my mind, then stop. Go back to go. You have to start the whole procedure over again. We're erring on the side of making sure the patient is protected.